Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Liberty Talk Radio, America's libertarian voice and independent streaming internet radio station. Available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, from our studio in Tulsa, Oklahoma, to around the world. I'm your host, Joe Cristiano, and this is your antidote to popular talk radio. This broadcast is being brought to you live on Wednesday evening, July 21st, 2010. It is now 8:31 p.m. Central Daylight Time in the good old USA. Folks, it's time for us to take back control of this government now before this bureaucratic, oversized, and self-serving federal government starves us of our property, our freedom, our rights, and our liberty. To do this, we must shed conventional thinking regarding our political structure. We need to be revolutionaries in thought, distance in action. Only after we recognize what our government is doing to our freedom and our Constitution will we start taking it back. And this program is just about that. Well, good evening, everyone. During our live broadcast, we invite you to call 646-652-4620. That's 646-652-4620. You can send us email anytime to comments@libertytalkradio.com. This evening, we are pleased to have a return guest, Andy Sutton from Sutton Associates. He's a chief strategist with them, and he will be discussing the worldwide economic malaise that we are going through that, quite frankly, I don't seem to understand. And I think he's on the line now. Let's get Andy on the pipe, and we'll get this program going. Andy, is that you?
It is. How you doing, Phil?
Okay, Andy. Thank you so much for being a guest on our program this evening.
Not a problem. Glad to be back.
Great, great. Well, I do want to mention to our audience and our guest, I guess, is that we do plan to have a regularly scheduled broadcast with you once a month, third Wednesday of every month, and we'll see how that goes.
You know, I'm looking forward to doing that just because it seems every time you and I get together, we can kill an hour fairly easily. And it seems like we don't even get through half of what we originally talked about getting through.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you're going to join. I know that I am. May I kick off this segment of the program with a typical Cristiano rant? Do you mind? And we'll take it from there.
Hey, you know what? Carry it away.
Okay. Well, I'm an investor. All my money is investing, and most of it, let's face it, is in commodities, to be honest with you. It's, in everything from wheat, corn, water, nuclear energy, you name it. It's a commodity. I have money into it, which means I have an incredibly volatile portfolio. No one in his right mind, though no financial consultant would ever recommend doing what I do, but I'm a little different. And so I typically have at least a feel for what is going on, a general idea. Not that I know what's going to happen, but I have a general idea or a feel for what is going on. However, today we have a debt problem that was horrendously bad. Not only was it not resolved, it is worse today, and people are talking about us getting out of it. I may be losing my mind, but for some reason that doesn't seem to make any sense. We also keep two sets of books, and both of them, neither one of them, would meet any definition of generally accepted accounting practices. Europe is has not emerged from its current crisis. The raiders and the sellers of the toxic financial waste were never prosecuted. Those bums thought that. In fact, they're making billions of dollars off of us right now. Germany is carrying all the other EU members. More money is being lent to within a failed system, not only in Europe, but in the UK as well as the United States. We have a birth rate that is declining, so you can forget about our traditional growth unless we bring in a lot of immigrants and we open the borders all the way. We continue to throw temporary funds at insolvent institutions. Business loans to small businesses, I understand, to small businesses is down something like 25%. Europe is mostly socialized, so any growth there has to be a growth in in government. However, they're taking the reverse role, which they're bound to go into a very steep recession soon because they're talking about limiting their spending. And it seems like the only way that we ever diverse our thinking, you know, is if we go to war. You know, if we start a war, then we forget about everything that's going on, which is probably what we will do. Housing continues to collapse. We need something like 125,000 to 150,000, depending on which statistic you use, new jobs every month just to keep even with the birth rate here in the United States. Our system is broken. No one has ever fixed it. Our real unemployment or underemployment, and these are good statistics from people who compile statistics. In fact, even the one that does it for the Christian Science Monitor, which has been, and other publications, which has been more accurate than our own government, says that it's like 22.6% at this point. And remember, the Depression was 25. College grads are now graduating but working at fast food joints. And all I hear in the mainstream media, which I listen very little to, is that we're working out of it slowly but surely. Now, I have lost my mind. Can you help me?
I don't know, Joe. I'd say we get on talking about how to stuff that elephant, like you were saying in the email you sent me today, because I think you about covered it.
You know, I am confused. Well, I am the most confused guy on this planet, I'll tell you that.
Well, I'm going to tell you what. Everything you just said for the past couple of minutes here hit most of the points that need to be hit as far as what the problems are. And the point is that the problems are structural. It's not just some ancillary thing or, you know, oh, if we could only get you know, these types of businesses to spend money or something along those lines. We've got structural issues. We've obviously a debt problem. And, you know, you mentioned how Europe is socialized and how the only way that they're going to grow out of this is if they spend their way out of it. That seems to be our mindset, too, that we can spend our way out of any period of economic contraction. And they tried that, and it didn't work.
Right.
They spent an awful lot of money. And one of the things I keep coming back to, I'm sure there's people that are listening to this show that haven't listened to prior ones, so I'm going to say it again, is the fact that we get less and less and less bang for our buck out of each subsequent stimulus that we do. Back in 2001, we did, it was around $150 billion, and we got a nice pop in GDP out of that. You know, this time, it took an awful lot more, somewhere in the order of 10 times that much spending, and we didn't even get that much of a pop in GDP. So you've got a situation where you've got the law of diminishing returns kicked in, and it's basically because you've got a government that's too big, and you have a whole bunch of people in that too big government that thinks that that government can create jobs, and that doesn't happen. Government can't create jobs, and you know, we could go into a whole hour on why the government can't create jobs. They can pay people to do stuff, but that's not a job.
Right.
You know, people will look at it and say, well, that's a paycheck. I'm working. I'm going out and I'm moving, you know, rocks from pile to pile B or whatever it is. I'm building a road or a bridge or a building. You know, particularly in the case of the roads and the bridges, I mean, sure, a lot of these bridges are falling apart, but what happens when the bridges, you know, the government spent $100 million on bridges, and when those bridges are finished, they have no way to pay for themselves.
Right. Right.
So then how does that worker continue to work? Well, they have to build another bridge.
Right.
You know, whereas if they took all that money that they were spending on this stimulus and they said, all right, you know, we're going to rebuild manufacturing base and we're going to put people to work building products that we can sell to our, not only ourselves but other countries, now you have something that would at least have a fighting chance of sustaining itself. But the problem is, Joe, we've been deindustrializing since, gosh, the late 1970s already.
That's correct.
It was really when we saw marked deindustrialization, and a lot of people say it was even before that, but that's probably as good a point as any for when things really got moving. So, you know, we've really kind of stacked the deck against any return manufacturing. Those are the core problems, and everything you mentioned kind of stems from that, that this core economic function is broken. And nobody's talking about it. Very few, I should say. A few people are starting to become aware of this, but the average person on the street is not really aware of this. They're listening to the mainstream press, and they're hearing, "Well, we've got a recovery," and now Bernanke's on TV today, and saying, "Well, you know, this recovery is really in bad shape, and we might have to do more things within the Fed. We might have to have more credit facilities. In other words, what we might have to do is maybe our Wall Street banker buddies aren't getting rich enough, so we need to fatten them up some more, and then, you know, you guys can play that game where you beg them to lend to the public." I mean, right. That's how this country has run for years now.
Yeah.
Banks lend money to people who are broke and don't have money but want to spend it anyway, and then the banks get rich off the interest.
Right.
We've been doing that since the early 1990s.
Right.
So this is what's going on, and these are all the core functions that are broken. And all the while, these guys are saying, "Oh, there's a recovery in place." No, there's not. There's no recovery. There's a minor bit of euphoric optimism from $1.5 trillion in deficit spending that was basically just pumped down a rat hole. And yeah, you got some pop. You know, these roads were built, and that required cement and some heavy equipment and all that kind of stuff. But now it's fading away. It's like it's like a drug dose. You know, you take the drug, you get high, and then the drug wears off. Well, then you need more drug. That's
right.
The same thing as what we're doing here.
Right. Well, you know, retail sales are not down. They're still up, not up very much, but they're still up a bit, 1.2% or something like that. I think in your newsletter you mentioned that, the sensible investor. But, you know, with all of the people out of work or underemployed or starting to save their money because they were afraid of the future, they're really concerned about the future, which is understandable, why is the spending still about the same level as it was last year?
Well, you have to understand, when you look at those retail numbers, those are adjusted for trading day differences and that sort of thing, but they're not adjusted for price changes. So, you know, there's all this talk that there's deflation and in terms of consumer prices, and that consumer prices are down dramatically and all this other stuff. Well, you know, a lot of that comes from the fact that gasoline dropped in price, and that's good for the consumer.
Right.
But it's a double-edged sword, Joe. When gas prices go down, retail sales go down because they don't calculate it in units. They calculate it in dollars.
Right.
So you have to keep that in mind, too. You know, if retail sales are growing at 5% a year and the CPI is 5%, well, then retail sales really aren't growing. If you take a look at year-over-year retail sales and year-over-year, even the ridiculous CPI, it basically wipes out the entire gain in retail sales. So retail sales, they're not collapsing by any stretch, but they're not going anywhere either. So people, there is a slow retrenchment, and a lot of people really, I think, have you know, had some egg on their face because they predicted this death, this, you know, dramatic, catastrophic death of the American consumer, and it just hasn't happened that way yet. And the problem is, not really the problem, but the reason why that hasn't happened is because you've got a Congress that wants to keep it, I'm not making value judgments on any of these initiatives, but you've got a Congress that's to keep extending unemployment benefits.
Okay,
and
that's
going to keep spending
that's
moving.
Right. That's
you know
right.
what I'm saying?
That's a good point. That's an excellent point.
Yeah, you know, whether or not we should increase those benefits or extend them or not, that's a whole side topic. I'm just talking about the effect of doing so. When you extend that, it keeps that whole subset of the population spending money.
Right.
And when you have another subset of people that basically are looking at their mortgage book and they're looking at their home appraisal and they're saying, "I'm 20% underwater, I'm 30% underwater, and my neighbor's been sitting in delinquency for a year and a half and nobody's bothered to do anything, I'm just going to stop paying my mortgage, I'm going to go shopping."
Right.
And that is going on
and
that keeps spending going.
Do we have a double dipping, I should say, in that some clown decided that government spending should be a component of GDP, which I don't understand at all. It should be subtracted from GDP. Am I thinking wrong? I mean, is that more logical, but to subtract it from GDP rather than add it to GDP? That's question number one.
The way I look at it, Joe, is if you have a government that has a savings account, like China, I'll use them as an example.
Okay.
They've foregone on current consumption and put their savings into an account, and they can spend it during times of economic sluggishness to kind of stimulate their economy, and that's what they've been doing over there for about the last year now.
Okay.
That's one thing. But when you have a country or a government that is in broke and in debt up to their earlobes and then some, going out and borrowing money and then spending it into the economy, that should absolutely not count as GDP.
Okay.
That's my opinion.
Right. But when
that
should
be pulled out of GDP.
When the government gives money to an unemployment, is that considered in the GDP, or is that absent of the GDP?
It gets back into it. I mean, it's not a direct.
It's not because I was
not directly calculated in, but the money gets spent, so
yeah,
eventually
gets spent,
it ends up
yeah.
there anyway.
I didn't know whether or not with the government spending the money on unemployment, that would be dollar one, and then they would count that same dollar when the consumer who receives it spends the money. So now we got $2 of spending for every dollar that's available.
Well, I mean, GDP is the sum of all the goods produced.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's not as direct as that.
Okay.
But you can make a certain correlation. Yeah. I mean, there is some double counting that goes on there, and people have argued for decades about this and how GDP ought to be effectively measured. Nobody seems to be really interested, especially not right now. Everybody's just worried at the end of the quarter, does the number go up or down? If it goes up, we clap and we say there's a recovery or that the economy is expanding. If it goes down, well, we say it's contracting and that we need more government spending. I mean, that's basically what GDP has been reduced to.
Right. Well, you hear a lot of people say, we need to get our manufacturing back. And we had a discussion at lunch last week with a group of ours, friends of mine. And they said, yeah, we need to get the manufacturing back. I said, well, let's assume we do. Let's assume we get and you fill in the blank what manufacturing it is. It makes no difference. We take it and they come here and they start manufacturing whatever it is, razor blades or whatever it is, you know, razors. And they make it here. Well, we make it here, right? And that same razor, assuming comparable quality, is also made in Vietnam or wherever, Thailand or China or whatever. And they make it, and you have an importer importing it, and the imported version is $59.95 retail. You know, you're making it here, and your version of it, again, assuming the quality is about consistently the same, your version is $129. How are you going to say, even if you manufacture it here, who is going to buy it?
Well, see, this is one of the big problems of globalization. You've got a severe, severe difference in cost of living, standard of living, working wages, salaries, whatever you want to call it, between the United States and a lot of these other countries.
Right.
And Vietnam is a good example, Taiwan, China, Japan, all of those places. And this is how we started to lose our manufacturing back in the 70s and the 80s
Right. Because
of this. It started, I mean, I'm pretty familiar with the steel industry, and this is how it worked in the steel industry. We couldn't compete on a price basis. Our quality was so much better. I mean, if you take a look at even today, Japanese cars, the bodies rust out on them, and they always have
Right. Because
the steel was not as good a quality as ours. But people, when they're starting to lose purchasing power and their money, they shop on price, and it was cheaper. There's a couple of ways you can combat that. The first thing which you can do is you can lower the wages here. Again, not making a value judgment, just talking about some options.
Right.
You could lower wages, or what you could do is you could duty your tariff the imports to discourage them flooding the market basically with imported goods, and you kind of introduce some level of parity. So to use your example, that $59 razor, we might put a $50 tariff on it, and all of a sudden, that becomes a $109 razor versus $120 razor. Then it makes the, buy USA, buy American made, that kind of thing. It makes it a little bit easier for people to justify doing it. The problem is, we get so much of our stuff from China, and we're in no position to put any tariff on them for anything, because if we do that, they stop the vendor financing, and then we have another problem.
Right.
Well, we don't get any goods.
Well, during the Depression, they
money.
Put the tariffs
up. You know,
they stop
buying Treasury.
Well, the tariffs are one of the components of the creation of the Great Depression of the 1930s is that they put all the tariffs up to protect all their industries. Everyone did that, and basically trade stopped, and everything went out the window.
Yeah, I mean, there was you can go back to that. So you've got a situation where we kind of have ourselves worked into a corner a little
right.
bit here. You can't yep. just tariff every single good that flies across the border.
Right. Yeah.
That's not really an effective option. So you've created this, you know, globalization has created this sliding scale, and it was always sold to people as, hey, you know, this is going to be fantastic. You know, everybody's going to have the same standard of living as they have over there in the USA. And that's not really going to be the case. You're going to see a situation where the living standard in the United States to work its way down to meet the rest of the world. And that's what we're going through right now.
Okay.
We're behind the eight ball in a lot of these areas just because we don't have any flexibility. We can't tariff Chinese goods because trade will stop. And what are we going to do for goods here in this country?
Right.
You know, we can't just snap our fingers and rebuild a manufacturing base. It just
right.
doesn't work that way.
Right.
And we've let it get so out of hand, it seems that, you know, especially in Washington, and it's that way with manufacturing, it's that way with the debt, it's that way with government spending. It seems like nobody wants to stand up and say, hey, we can't do this anymore. Or if they do, they get laughed at by the knuckleheads
right.
in the mainstream press,
right.
Like Ron Paul did. People just say, you know, it's easier to just keep doing this until it just doesn't go anymore.
Right.
And that seems to be what people have resigned themselves to, whether it's policymakers, politicians, financial folks, media, whatever the case is. Well, we'll just keep going, and we'll just keep doing the same old thing and the same old thing, and one day it'll stop going. And, well, I guess we'll have to figure out then. We'll probably go back to war.
That's
know,
right.
Like that.
We'll have a war, and it'll fix that. Let me just interrupt for a second for station identification, and we have a caller, and we'll go through station identification, then we'll take our caller. Okay, Andy?
Folks, sure, that sounds good.
This is Liberty Talk Radio. I'm your host, Joe Cristiano, and with us this evening we have Andy Sutton, Chief Strategist for Sutton Associates, Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, and we're talking about the worldwide economic crisis. We do encourage you to call 646-652-4620, 646-652-4620. Don't worry about interrupting us. Call at any time. We'll put you in the queue and ask your question, and we have a caller right now. Caller, you're on the air. Your first name and where you're calling from, please.
Hey, Joe. This is Jim, Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Oh, Jim. Hi. How are you?
Good, good. Andy, how are you this evening?
Good, Jim. How are you?
Good, good. I've called in once before, and I enjoy your 2 cents commentary emails that you send. I try to keep up on financial economic news, and what I wanted to ask you is not what Bernanke said today that caused the market to drop or any economic data per se, but from all of that I read and study through primarily alternative sources such as you and some subscriptions through the Agora Financial Stansberry people, which you may be familiar with, I'm deeply concerned about the direction of this country. Structurally, not only the economics of the Keynesian economics and our debt, but also I think our government and Congress is structurally flawed too. I think it's a two-headed monster, and I'm very discouraged and concerned. So, my question is, I'm to the point where, as Joe knows, I'm planning a trip to some Central American countries next year to look for some real estate as a second or vacation home, but possibly also an escape route, a place that may be a simpler, lower cost, more pleasant life than what might be in store for this country. So, am I overreacting, or do you hold out optimism that America in 5, 10, or 20 years is going to rebound, be strong? And I don't know if you've got kids, you know, a family, but I have terrible concerns about where this country is headed. And I wondered if you hold out optimism despite all the troubles, and if so, why?
Well, to answer your question shortly, Jim, I mean, I've got a family also, and one of the things I do a lot is I study history, because I'm very convinced that the human animal, so to call it, doesn't really change very much over time. People's human nature can change. People are generally motivated by the same things throughout history. The flavors change, the names change, but really it's generally the same kind of a thing. And what I've found time and time and time again is that people are very loath to be proactive. They're reactive. And you know, I'm talking in mass. Now, certainly within a population of people, there's going to be members of the cohort that are obviously more proactive, and they will look to avert things and do those types of things. However, in mass, we're very reactive, and we wait until crises happen. What has shocked me continually is that we went through a pretty nasty spell back in 2008, and people, by and large, have shrugged it off, and, well, you know, I lost the house, so what? The 401k is cut in half, so what? No big deal, you know, whatever. I'm just going to keep doing what I've been doing. And that has me very concerned, because what that tells me is, A, we've learned nothing, and, B, we're setting ourselves up for an even worse problem. And then you take all these other things like this ballooning debt, and you just look at what's going on over in Europe, and that's really only getting started. You know, there's rioting and all of these unpleasant kinds of things. The press doesn't seem to want to focus on them too much because, you know, it might disturb people right. or whatever. But, I mean, I'm very concerned about that stuff. I would say as far as, you know, what you're talking about doing, it's up to every person to decide what their comfort level is with you know, the living situation, the living arrangements. If you're one of those people you think you might do better somewhere else, then I would say, hey, you know, go for it, do your homework, due diligence, take a look. It's really going to depend on what everybody's comfort level is. It's kind of a lousy answer, but, I mean, it's really got to be a personal decision.
And beyond that, I was more interested in hearing that you had optimism that in 5, 10, 20 years that this country is going to wake up, and whether it be a revolution or through great leadership or having to hit rock bottom to have some kind of you know, renaissance period to become a world leader and restore our greatness.
I think your last one was about where I stand. I'll have optimism when we hit the bottom.
Yeah.
It's unfortunate to say that, but like I said, people historically, unless we have this mass catharsis within the American psyche, and it's not even just the American psyche, it's within the human psyche in a lot of these developed nations, unless we have a massive awakening of sorts, and I just don't see it happening. I mean, yeah, there's pockets here and there, and that's great, but the hard thing is to get the other 95% on board, and the other 95%, at least to my observation and experience and understanding, couldn't care less right now.
Well, I was going to say one reason I posed that question is I can't pose it to everyone. A lot of people think you're crazy or an alarmist, and I appreciate your sincere and heartfelt understanding and response to my question.
Yeah,
Jim. No, I appreciate your question and your phone call.
Yeah, let me add something, Jim. In my opinion, we're not going to get that. Hit bottom, truly hit bottom, because the government will not allow us to. They'll continue to print more money. They'll be artificially stimulating the economy. They'll do whatever it is to prevent the hitting of bottom, which is what happened basically in the 1930s, which means we will be in the same route as Japan. We will go for 10, 20, maybe 30, who knows? Noriel Robini says we're going to stay this way for 50 years because we're just going to be in this malaise constantly, and every time we should just crash and then clean out the system and, you know, and have this renaissance, the government's going to come in and prevent that from happening. Now, who knows who's right on that one, but apparently many of the bigwigs are saying we ain't going to hit bottom. We're not going to allow it to hit bottom. So we can count on this for a long time.
And you may be right. One thing that I would enjoy, that I would like to study as a not much of a historian, is how Germany recovered from the Weimar Republic hyperinflation period, and the history behind that, and how they rebounded. Yeah. That'd be an interesting
military. Military, I think okay. That's it,
yeah,
it's
you know,
military, is it?
You saw what arose from that whole mess. I mean, really had the Weimar experience, and then that, you know, a lot of that crisis and the spinoffs from that whole situation really was what gave rise to, you know, the Third Reich and Adolf Hitler, that dark time. So, you know, nothing good comes of these things. You know, and to make a kind of a comment on what Joe said about the government not allowing us to hit bottom. I think in the short run, that's probably true. I mean, they certainly did it back in 2008. But you've seen that it takes more and more extension on their part to get less and less and less of a preventative, so to speak, from doing exactly that. I think at the point, you could very well run into a situation where we hit bottom precisely because of the government.
Right.
I mean, I don't think they can lower the interest rate much lower, can they?
No, they can't. No.
And I think, Jim, when we hit bottom, the bottom is going to be much, much deeper the longer we wait, because as you hear on TV very often, we keep on kicking the can down the road. No one wants to pick it up.
Well, one of the best at drawing analogies to our government's economic laws and processes is Peter Schiff, where, you know, he refers it to being a drunk or a drug addict, that you know keep giving him another shot of heroin, and he doesn't recover, but you know, for the moment he's high and has his
right
fix.
Yeah.
So I don't know, but again, Joe, Andy, enjoy your banter and your emails, and keep up the good work, and somehow we'll make it through this mess.
Okay, thank you, Jim.
We will somehow. Yes.
Thanks again. I'll hang up and listen to the remainder of the show.
Thank you, guys. Right.
Thanks, Jim.
Yeah. Well, you know, his concern is a concern of many people that I know. And Andy, I wish I could tell you these guys were crackpots, but these people are six-figure earners. Family people, I mean, just regular, really nice guys, you know, middle class, you know, doing well in the whole bit. And they're talking about going to Ecuador, Costa Rica, Argentina. I mean, it's as if they've all gone wacko. But they talk about this stuff.
They haven't gone wacko. You know, people that are paying attention are feeling like they're under attack.
Yeah.
They feel like they're under siege, and they're doing what anybody would do that is of a sound mind. They're trying to figure out a way to, you know, maybe not escape it, but at the very least create a more favorable situation. And you know, and I feel what Jim's dilemma is here. I mean, anybody who's family, it really is not a good time to have to consider a lot of these things. Just there's just so many. You know, and I hate to sound like a gloomer, and you know, I spend my days a lot of time trying to find a bright spot in this,
yeah,
and trying to find instances where, you know, the government is going to do the right thing. And, you know, I said way, way back in 2006 or 2007, whenever it was, when this whole housing thing started to come unglued, I said, hey, look, you know, we're going to have a chance to do this right. We can either do it right, or we're going to screw this economy up. We're going to screw this country up for decades if we don't get this right. And we haven't gotten it right. We didn't act when we should have. We acted when we shouldn't have. We've acted improperly. We've acted foolishly. We've been impulsive, compulsive, destructive. I mean, it seems like we're 0 for the ball game here, or darn close to it. And it's very discouraging.
Well, I think many people feel that whatever Washington did, they did to bail out their friends in Wall Street, because their friends in Wall Street are the ones that are the advisors to the president anyway. So it's one big happy family, one big party going on. We haven't been invited to the party. We've just been asked to pay for it. We have another caller on the air. But before we do, let me take a chance for a station identification. Folks, this is Liberty Talk Radio. I'm your host, Joe Cristiano. We have with us this evening Andy Sutton, Chief Strategist for Sutton Associates, Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. We're talking about the worldwide economic situation, and we welcome your calls on any subject, 646-652-4620, 646-652-4620. Your email, please, anytime, to comments at libertytalkradio.com. Now, let's see who we have on the air. Caller, you're on the air. Your first name and where you're calling from, please.
Yes, hi. This is calling from Atlanta, Georgia.
Who is this?
This is Adam from Atlanta.
Oh, Adam. Okay, we're getting a skip on the phone for some reason. So when you mentioned your name, Adam, I did not hear it at all. Well, hello, Adam. You also are a repeat caller, aren't you?
Yes, I am, Joe. I enjoy your show very much.
Thank you.
And I'd like to take this opportunity to ask Mr. Sutton, is there any way for him to estimate, or would he be willing to speculate on how this current economic crisis would have been different in America if the U.S. had been on the gold standard?
That's a good question, and it's one I get asked a whole lot. Basically, what would have happened if we had remained on, now it depends what kind of a gold standard you're talking about. If you're talking about a straight reserve gold standard like we had many, many years ago, or if you're talking about kind of the Bretton Woods situation where we just settled foreign debt in gold. But in either case, if we were still settling foreign debts in gold, we wouldn't have been able to run up the foreign external debts that we have, because that was why I jumped off of it in 1971 anyway, is because we were running out of gold. We would not have been able to do that if we had been forced to remain on the gold standard. So you wouldn't have had all of these imbalances in the system. You wouldn't have had unfunded liabilities of hundreds of trillions of dollars. You wouldn't have had a $13 trillion national debt. You would have had to have discipline, and this is one of the reasons why countries have a hard time staying on metal standards, whether it's gold or silver or copper. It could be wheatgrass for all. It's very hard to stay on a standard just because of the fact that governments by nature want to overspend. They want to buy votes, and this is not just in America. This goes on many, many times in many, many different centuries throughout history. Governments have tried to do this. So it's not, it's kind of, let me read the question. How would have it been different in 2006, 7, and 8 if we had been on this gold standard all this time? We wouldn't have had this problem if we would have been on the gold standard. You wouldn't have had the ability to develop all of these massive imbalances that were built up over the last 30-some years. So, it's not to say that on a gold standard you're going to have turmoil or malaise or things like that, but they're always going to be limited because you don't have the ability to get yourself into trouble because you're on that discipline, you're on that standard. So it's kind of a generic answer, but it really would not have happened that way if we had been on a strict monetary standard. And if you look at what, and to bolster that, just look at what has happened to the dollar since we went off. It's gone done nothing but go down in value. And that's the root cause of a lot of these problems. The supply of dollars, the speculation that resulted from the supply of dollars, the fractional reserve system, all of these kinds of things you wouldn't have had such a problem with if we just stayed on that gold standard.
Well, I appreciate your answer. Thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome.
Adam, thank you very much for calling in. Well,
Joe, that's a good question that he asked, and it's something that comes up an awful lot because people have a hard time, I think, picturing how America today would look under a gold standard because we've been off it for so long. And I think the important thing to remember is what the benefits of having that standard are. You know, you don't have this massive leveraging. You don't have the massive speculation. There's not, if you want to expand the supply of money, you have to expand the supply of gold. You do that by running external surpluses. so that other countries are sending you more gold. Obviously, you can mine it if you have the ability to do so. But that's productive activity. You've got a mine, you've got labor that goes into that. All those types of things. Those are all things that tend to grow economies. You don't get to sit on your behind and push paper and consume the production of the rest of the world on a gold standard. It doesn't work that way. It requires discipline, and that's one of the reasons why governments and nations can't stick to it, because it's not the easy way. It's the hard way. It's the narrow path, not the wide path.
Yeah, it would be interesting to have a flowchart on what would happen to goods if now we were buying from overseas because we were uncompetitive, and we were importing more, then most of this gold would be leaving our treasury, and eventually we would have no gold, and thus we would have no currency. So we would have to be forced to make some systemic changes in the United States to become competitive again, to encourage people to buy what we have. And we haven't done that. We just said, heck, we'll just owe the money somewhere down the road. Wow. That's such an interesting question.
That's exactly what happened.
In an email that you sent me, you wanted to talk a little bit about the high interest rates on various loans, excluding mortgages. You want to say a few words about that, Andy?
Well, and this is kind of something that I think really people need to think a little bit more closely about. We have a situation where any day you can turn on the news, pick up a newspaper, whatever, listen to a radio show, and you can hear about the credit crisis, and you can hear about how banks aren't lending to businesses, and you accurately nailed the number, it's off 25%. You can hear about how mortgages are harder to come by. And again, I'm not making value judgments on any of these things. Right. Some of these things should be happening, like mortgages being harder to get. This idea of no-doc loans, I mean, that was ridiculous. It should have never been done to begin with. But anyway, so you've got this situation where, everybody's talking about this. And you have to think about, all right, let's kind of tear this thing down to its bare bones structure here. You've got a situation where banks essentially have a no-risk environment that they operate in.
Right.
Let me just go through this. So the banks, they have some money. They can borrow money from the Fed for essentially nothing. They can get it through these various types of credit facilities. They can take their junky assets off their balance sheets and give it to the Fed, and the Fed gives them money.
Right.
Well, that's a pretty good deal. you've got the overnight rate is 25 basis points between 0 and 25. That's the target. So it's very low. It's almost nothing. So the cost of capital for banks is essentially free.
Right.
And they can turn it around. And the average credit card rate, I'm just going to pick on credit cards now, the average credit card rate is somewhere around 13%. So they can take that money that they get for nothing, and they can lend it out at 13%, and they can take all that profit home.
Right.
And if it goes bad, all they have to do is run to Congress and say, if you don't bail us out, the whole financial system's going to collapse.
Right.
They'll do a Hank Paulson. He did work for Goldman Sachs before he went to the government.
Right.
The whole economy is going to collapse. The financial system is going to be destroyed. There's going to be a depression, all these other things, and Congress will immediately whine and complain and grind their teeth and all this. Oh, but we have to do it because we have to save the financial system. So this is a no-risk environment for banks. The question is not that the banks aren't lending to people or businesses. The question should be why?
Right.
You've got, think of yourself, Joe. You're a banker now. You've got money coming in at 25 basis points. It's going out at 13%, so you're harvesting 12.75% interest. Yeah, you pay your employees and all that other stuff, but that's a huge margin.
Right.
And if it goes boom, if you lend to the wrong guy and it goes bust, or you lend to 10,000 of the wrong guys and it goes kaboom again, you just get another bailout.
Right.
Why are they not lending? This is the question. Why are they not lending? And see, this is where you get into kind of the things that Jim's worried about, and kind of things that a lot of your friends are probably worried about, and I'm worried about, and other people. I don't know that this is just, hey, we got burned. We better pull back a little bit we better be a little bit more careful about who we lend to. I think you're in a situation here where you've got some sort of, I don't know if it's coordinated or not, I'm not a tinfoil guy or anything like that, but a situation where there's an incentive not to get this economy moving, because they know that GDP is dependent on credit. They know the consumer is responsible for 70% of GDP.
Right.
They know the consumer is broke. They've done nothing to help the consumer.
Right.
They've done everything to help the banking sector. So you've got this banking sector. Who was it the other day? Was it Morgan Stanley? One of those guys. They just, their profit was up like 78% or 88%
yeah.
or whatever the case may be. All these big banks are making money. I mean, Goldman, you know, they were off a little bit, but you know, their stock went up anyway the other day here.
But they were still in the billions. They just
made billions. These guys are all making lots of money.
Right.
And you had so little, like 95% of this bailout money went to the banks.
Right.
And it went to, you know, buy auto companies, and it went to take over banking companies and all this other stuff. And maybe 5% of it, you know, pablum, went down to Main Street. It went down to the consumer. Yeah, they threw out some tax credits for people to buy houses. That was a home builder's bailout. They had so much inventory to work off, so the government bailed out the home builders. That's really what that was. It wasn't a bailout for the consumer. It was a bailout for the home builders, and it didn't even work.
Right.
It didn't create any demand. It just rearranged demand that already existed. But the fundamental question, Joe, here, that needs to be asked, why are these guys not lending? And what are the motives behind why they're not lending? I'm submitting to you on this show tonight that it's not because they're afraid of getting burned again. I'm submitting to you that it's not because the government has said, hey, we're not going to do this again. I'm submitting that there's another reason. I don't know what it is, but I don't think it's because they're afraid of getting zapped in another derivatives bubble. I mean, that's still going on. It's not that they're worried about getting zapped with more default credit cards or more defaulted mortgages or anything like that. I'm submitting that there's another reason.
Well, it could it be that they want to reserve?
I think people need to think about that.
Yeah. Okay. The auto industry, how does General Motors compete against, I mean, how does Ford compete against General Motors when General Motors is basically an arm of the federal government? Doesn't that really distort the competitive marketplace for the auto industry here in the United States?
Oh, sure. That any government nationalizes something.
Yeah.
There's countless examples of this happening in different parts of the world. Any time government nationalizes something, basically you have a situation where that company doesn't need to make profit anymore. It becomes kind of like the government.
Right.
You know, the government doesn't worry about finances. They don't care how they can use a 5-gallon drum of red ink every quarter to generate their financial statements, and it's okay because it's the government. They can do that. You know, you and I, we run a business, and if we do that, we're soon not running a business anymore.
Right.
You have a little bit of that gets injected into this thing. You know, you've got a situation where the government can favorites with its own company versus other companies. And there's been a lot of people that have said, hey, you know, I don't really follow the auto industry as a sector. By and large, but you've had a lot of people have screamed about this Toyota thing and saying, hey, why is Toyota being persecuted when all of a sudden the government owns one of its biggest competitors?
Right.
You know, I don't know. Maybe they just had a really long run of bad luck with these accelerator pedals and all this other stuff going on. But there's a lot of people that are saying, hey, they're being attacked now that all of a sudden the government owns one of their competitors.
That's right.
So, you know, you basically have an unlevel playing field, and I think a lot of people have responded to that by going out and buying Fords.
Right. You know, I know of a lot of people who will not buy a General Motors car because they're owned by the government, because they're out of spite.
Exactly.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yes,
and I feel the same
exactly.
way. I'll be honest with you. I wouldn't buy a GM because of that. Even if there was a car I wanted, I wouldn't buy a GM. I couldn't bring myself to it. Isn't that horrible? what do you think about this unemployment being extended past the 99 weeks?
Well, you know, again, I mean, fiscally, it's terrible. All we're doing, again, is, like you mentioned earlier, we're kicking the can down the road. We're not solving the fundamental problem. why are these people unemployed? That's the fundamental problem.
Right.
Nobody's asking. Everybody's trying to figure out how are we going to get these guys more money? How can we keep the spending going? That's what it's about. It's not. Nobody's asking the fundamental question. Well, why don't they have a job? And as long as that's not being addressed, then they may as well make it 200 weeks or 500 weeks.
Right.
Now, on the other side of the coin, you have a humanitarian issue there. What happens if you have 5 or 10 million people that lost their jobs, they used up their savings? I mean, people generally don't have very much savings today, unfortunately,
yeah, right.
So there isn't a cushion to begin with, and the unemployment starts running out. That's not going to be good either. We already have a record number of people in this country on food stamps,
right,
and other kinds of assistance. What? See, this is the problem. We've got this tug of war. We've got a society where we try to take care of people. And when people, somebody loses a job, I mean, they pay into those unemployment insurance funds. So I don't have a problem with people getting unemployment. The problem is now that becomes their job because there are no opportunities.
Right.
And we lost a huge number of people out of the workforce last month because they just gave up.
Right.
There's no opportunities out there for them, and they say, you know what, I can't do it. When the surveyor calls and they say, have you looked for work in the last month? They say no, and all of a sudden they've left the workforce as far as the Bureau of Labor Statistics is concerned. That's how it's done.
What happens to the person who is not categorized as unemployed but has no income? They get nothing. Isn't there a moral hazard here where then the government really should be sending checks to absolutely everyone who does not have a full-time job?
Well, see, this is kind of part of the flip side of this whole thing. Where does it stop?
Right.
And, you make a very good point, because there's people in our government that are proposing we do exactly that, that the government needs to send everybody a check that is fully employed. And we've already begun this idiotic and ridiculous health care nonsense that's going to totally screw up our healthcare system for generations.
Right.
Not just, and I'm only talking fiscally. I'm not even talking about the other issues involved there, and there's plenty. And I got called every name in the book, and I was called a liar and a phony, and I was even called a Republican by somebody, which was actually worse than calling me a phony. When I wrote that piece on healthcare and gave a few of the examples of what I thought was going to happen because of it, and lo and behold, if they're not starting to come out of the woodwork now, where it's becoming this, the IRS is getting all these new powers, right. And I was a tinfoil hat guy, and all you had to do was read it.
Right. It's so interesting because you have people now struggling to make ends meet who are working, and now the money for the extended unemployment is going to come out of their pocket. Now, so you bifurcate the nation. You say, no, stop giving my money away. I can't afford it anymore. And that's the way I see it.
Well,
this is fractions against each other.
Yeah, what you're going to have is not a recipe, and it hasn't started yet, and I hope it doesn't, but what you have here is a recipe for class warfare,
right.
Basically.
Yeah.
When you think about it, because you've got one portion of the population that is on the giving end or the being taken from end, and you have the other half of the population, and that's basically what it is now. You've got about half that are paying and about half that are receiving. And you've got the other half that's on the receiving end, and they're saying, give me more, I can't get a job. Some are saying, hey, I don't want to work at all.
Right.
Why should I work when I have a check coming in every month? There's a lot of that going on, too.
Yeah. Right.
Don't make any mistake about, me thinking that it's just all, poor people who have lost their jobs. I know there's a lot of system gaming that's going on right now, too, and it's in the food stamps and the energy assistance, and it's in all these areas. That's a recipe for class warfare. The people that are being taken from to pay for these benefits, especially when you start hearing about these cases of abuse, they get mad.
Right.
And the people that think they're entitled to it and maybe they're not getting what they think they're entitled to, they get mad too. And that's just, that's not pleasant. And I hope it doesn't really escalate. I mean, it hasn't yet, thank God. And I hope it doesn't. But, I mean, the ingredients are in the mixing bowl there for that kind of a situation. And it's easy to see how it can happen.
Well, I met a gentleman at the doggy park when I was, you know, we have a dog park around our area, who was retired, had a very good retirement income from a big company here in Tulsa, worked there like 45 years. He was on Social Security, and he was on unemployment. Doesn't that just kick you? Now, there's got to be a point where you say, well, when do we... Oh, and not only that, but now the new government audit, whatever they did on unemployment, found that like 30% of it is fraudulent. So all this money is... is just going, which is about what the fraud is on all the other government programs. Anyway, Andy, we have 4 minutes left. Let me give you 2 or 3 minutes to wrap it up. Tell the folks who you are, how they can reach you, and whatever else you want to say, and that'll give me a minute to close out the station, okay? Go to it.
All right, Joe. Well, first of all, I'm looking forward to coming back here on a quasi-regular basis here on the third week of every month. I think that's going to be good. It'll give us a chance to kick a lot of these issues around. Basically, what I do is kick around a lot of these things that you and I have just talked about and try to, you know, put that into a picture to help clients. And we look at the geopolitical side. We look at the policy, the fiscal issues in America. We look at the generational issues, demographics, economics, finance, all of these types of things to try to form strategies for people. And it doesn't always include investing in share markets or bond markets or things like that. I mean, we do a lot of different things with our clients, and I think it's important to stress that. I'm not a stockbroker. I'm an advisor, and there's a big difference there. And, you know, as far as, our newsletter, I mean, we put it out monthly around the 15th of every month. It goes out. There's a lot of good information in there. And all I'm going to say about it is, you know, if you're listening to this show or if you listen to some of the other shows, you've read the commentaries, and you appreciate what I'm trying to do here, I do work alone. This is how I feed my family. This is how I support myself. I'd really appreciate it if you consider supporting it. Support the newsletter. There's partial year subscriptions available. I try to make it as affordable as I possibly can. That's the reality. You know, I'm not here driving around in, Lamborghinis and that kind of stuff. I'm just a regular guy trying to make a living. And if you appreciate what we're trying to do, I just appreciate it if you think about supporting it.
How can they reach you, Andy? Where will they find you?
They can find me either through the website. It's www.sutton-associates.net, or they can give us a call. The phone number is 888-633-5420.
Very good. Well, Andy, thank you so much for a real lively broadcast this evening. You're right, it flew by, and it's really great, and I look forward to another one the third week in August, the third Wednesday in August, right?
Joe, I'm looking forward to it. Pleasure being here, and thanks again for having me.
All right, thank you, and good night, Andy. Wow, that was a great show. I look forward to having Andy back. This is the end of today's broadcast. We'd like to thank Ranch Acres Audiology for their financial support, and we'd like to thank you for listening in. You can further the cause of liberty by recommending this program to your friends and let us hear from you. Our email address is comments@libertytalkradio.com. Remember, you are either allowing your liberties to be taken away or you're striving to protect them. Unfortunately, folks, there is no middle ground. Folks, freedom is like riding a motorcycle. You feel free, liberated. Your life is in your own hands. But with that freedom comes responsibility and risk. The government is like training wheels. They control the ride and your every move. Ron Paul has a sign as this that says, don't steal. The government hates competition. With that, until next time, I'm Joe Cristiano. This is Liberty Talk Radio. Stay well. Stay tuned.